Good morning. You know, when I look around, there's a lot of you I know from various places. I can't admit it in public, but there's a lot of you. And, you know, there's supposed to be three of us on the program, but one is on MARTA trying to get here. And got the plane got canceled last night, and so he'll be on the road. But they still didn't give me extra time. And sometimes when I'm at an event like this, I feel like the little boy in the spelling bee, and his word was banana. And he said, banana, B-A-N-A-N-A-N-A-N-A. And the teacher said, wait, what are you doing? He says, well, I know how to spell it. I just don't know when to quit. And that had been true of me. And as I was checking in, I said, you know, there's a new 12-step group, and it's only for clergy. It's only for clergy. And it's called On and On Anon. And with that note, we'll see if I can get anywhere with this talk, but I am so thrilled to be here. How many of you were at this same program in Toronto 10 years ago? Because I'm going to tell the same stuff. But we'll see if you stayed with the program and your memory is good. But the thing I want to start with is there came a point in my life and my career where I was at the only job, the only position that I thought I really wanted in life. Now, it may come as a big surprise to you that clergy, that we do have egos, and we do have willfulness, and every day I pray to be willing, not willful. It's because I need it every day, and sometime during the day I will forget that. But I was in the position that I thought was just the greatest position in the whole world, in charge of a worldwide prayer ministry that had millions of people calling and writing, and a publication had 2.5 million subscribers. I wrote for that and so forth. And there came a little bit of a challenge in that I was married at the time to the great-granddaughter of the founders of my denomination. And she became the president, and I became the vice president, and then she divorced me. After divorce, I worked for her for 5 years. And finally, I decided that was a punishment enough. And I said to her, I think you need to take some time off and get professional help. And I was invited to find my good elsewhere. And now, I say that and we laugh and it's funny, but all of you who have been through things like that, you know, it's good when you can get to the point 25 years later that you can laugh at it. But the truth is, the position had become toxic for me. And I did what I didn't know the name of at the time, but I learned that, a geographic solution. How many of you have ever done a geographic solution? Well, I didn't know I was doing a geographic. And I went to this other great position, New York City. And you can guess with a accent like my country boy goes to the big city. And it was, in many ways, another dream job. But I knew, probably within the first couple of days, I didn't know the name geographic, but I know I had done one. I had gone from one place that was unhealthy for me to another one just as unhealthy. And I didn't know what you know. And, you know, somebody said, experience is the best school, but the tuition is the highest. And so, you know, so I'm there, I was struggling mightily. I had remarried and really married up, and that was a good thing. And, you know, when I tell women that I married up, they said, all men do. You know, so I had married up. She was back in Kansas City, and I was in New York, and just deteriorating, really. And a friend of mine, who had become one of my dearest friends for a quarter of a century, said, "John, I want you to go to an AA meeting with me." And I said, "But I'm not an alcoholic." And he said, "No, but you are crazy." And so I went, and I said, "This is really good. Maybe I should take up drinking." I said, No, you don't really want to do that. And there was another dear friend there, and she used to put on weekend recovery retreats. She said, "John, I want you to go to weekend recovery retreat." And it was one of the most magnificent things. And you see, both of these were two really great gifts to me from people who love me. And there's a lot of people who love you, but they don't have the courage to tell you when you're screwed up and you're not doing well. And it really, for me, it was depression. And, you know, I'd been the head of this worldwide prayer ministry that many people had found healing and sobriety and new life through, and I was supposed to be this great example and to admit to myself that I suffered from depression. I remember when I finally outed myself to a congregation, and it was a great relief. You know, when you finally admit I'm an alcoholic or I'm depressed or I got this or I got that, and there's a load off of you. And that was one of the greatest things that could have happened, and it couldn't have happened without friends saying, "John, we love you, and we want you to know." And it took a lot of courage on their part. So I go to those weekend recovery. And one of the things about that was these friends were afraid I was going to do just another geographic. Well, this didn't work, that didn't work, this didn't work. Let's go find another. Let's find another job, another place, another city, another girl, another whatever, you know. You know the drill. You know the drill. And you keep finding yourself there or you don't find yourself. Maybe that's the problem. But one of the speakers, one of these great, great speakers in the recovery movement said, "Your first responsibility is self-care, self-preservation." And I knew I had to leave, and I wasn't ready to go find another church or another position somewhere. And I really had felt at this point that if I didn't, that my wife would come and get me and take me home in a body bag. Any of you been that low? You know, in having some discussion yesterday with some of you, I realized that there's something about alcoholism and depression. It kind of like they go together, you know. It's like, to try to be an inspirational leader and I used to in New York speak to maybe thousands of people, get a standing ovation, and I'd go back to my apartment and I'd curl up in a fetal position and just whimper. You know, and then the next time it comes, you put on Showtime. You know, any of you ever suffer from that need to always look good? Gee whiz, man! But I needed to heal up, and so I did resign that position, and Brenda took me back to Kansas City, and we moved in with her folks for a while, till I could do the work. You got to do the work. I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. So. Then I saw an opportunity in a position where I'd always wanted to live, Denver, Colorado. I'm a mountain man, you know. This is And I went and interviewed there with the board, and I said, "This is toxic." So I said no. And I thought saying no can be such a wonderful, powerful, great thing. And some of us in the ministry are people pleasers. We say yes to everybody, you know. It's like, and we give and we give and we give, and there's nothing left, you know. And you know what? Most of you flew here, and at some point they say, put on your oxygen mask first. You got to put on your oxygen mask. So I knew that wasn't the right thing. And then, golly, I got exiled to Honolulu, Hawaii. If you gotta be exiled, I mean, that's the place to be, isn't it? Some of our friends from Hawaii are here. There's a great 12-step community there and in our church. But you know, you think about it. There you are in paradise. But if you don't have paradise within you, you're in hell. You're in hell. And so, anyway, to go there, that was so healing for me. And while I was there, there was a minister on the mainland who created a program for abundant living. And he was a 12-stepper. And he outed himself, and he created this program based on the 12 steps. And his point was, everybody is addicted to something. even if it's just the way life is. I want it the way it is. Don't want anybody messing with it. Don't want change. I don't want laws to change. I don't want this to change. I don't want people to move away. I don't want my friends to die. I don't want all this sort of stuff, you know. It's like, we want it the way it is. And those years where I was the director of this worldwide prayer ministry, and when I was being prepared for that, I worked all the jobs in that prayer ministry, from pushing the mail cart to data entry to, although they didn't really let me live with that. They could tell my skills with data entry. Answering phones and answering letters. And the great preponderance of the people who contacted the prayer ministry, and they were from all denominations, Christian, non-Christian, or no religion at all, they wanted a better life. But very few of them said, I want a wholesale change of me. You know, I want my wife to change. I want my job to change. I want a better job. I want a house. I want a better house. I want a car. I want this. I want that. Pray for that. Pray for my healing. But how many of them say, I want to pray for a change of me? And you do that. You do that. And that's remarkable. That's remarkable. So this minister developed this abundant living program based on 12 steps. And he had done it in the San Francisco Bay Area, personally. And he called me one and said, John, would you do this in Hawaii? Would you offer this in your church in Hawaii? I said, let me look at it. And some of those 12 steps just scare the whatever's out of me. Did it you when you first presented? We're going to start out with surrender. I'm going to do a fearless personal inventory. Okay? But then I'm going to have to tell it to one person. Minister, I'm going to do that. I don't want anybody in the world to know the deep, dark secrets in me. And at that time, I sure didn't want anybody to know that I suffered from depression. What is it about that don't want people to know? Do you remember it's been many years, if you're old enough, remember there was a vice presidential candidate who got revealed. Thomas Eagleton had treatment for depression. And the presidential candidate immediately said, I'm behind him 1,000%. But then the next week, he was removed, and they had another one. I'd say, well, God bless, you know, Abraham Lincoln suffered from depression, you know, for crying out loud. It's a good thing that you can be who you are and be loved for that. And if you can't, then, you know, it's still good that people know who you are and what you are. So we did that. But that idea that you can't have an abundant, fulfilling life unless you work the 12 steps. That was my introduction in a big way to the 12 steps. And it is life transformative. And we say, well, it's a spiritual program, not a religion. You know, I think most religions did start as a spiritual program, and including mine. And I don't want to criticize yours, but we went downhill when we became a religion. We were, you know, my denomination was just an eclectic gathering of thoughts from here and there, east and west, and all that. And I grew up in, I'm one of the rarities in Atlanta, Georgia, who grew up in that. And I've been sent to hell by lots of people for being open-minded and a positive thinker, you know, and meditating. You know, you all probably meditate today, but back in the 60s, my mother taught me to meditate when I was a little kid, you know. She didn't want to tell anybody. Man, you know, but it's one of the great healing things in my life. Well, I finally found my way back to Atlanta. And so I was gone for 27 years, and I finally came back, and I said, all my Sunday school teachers, and I went back to the very church I grew up in, all my Sunday school teachers had either died or forgiven me, so I could come home. But some of them did say, John, why were you so mean to me when you were in? I said, no, that wasn't me, that was my brother. You know, so, oh, denial. It's like, oh, will we ever get beyond that? But in Atlanta, I've had some really, truly magnificent experiences. And one of them is that I've made a deep friendship with Dr. Lawrence Carter at Morehouse College. He's the dean of Martin Luther King Jr. Chapel. And I'm very honored to have been inducted into the Morehouse Board of Preachers. For a white kid from College Park, that's woohoo, you know. And this year, my wife got inducted into the Morehouse Board of Sponsors. She's written a great book on eclectic spirituality, everyday spirituality. But I was invited to an anniversary of Dean Carter's 25th anniversary, and a lot of students there feel the call to go into ministry, and they have to come see him. And he says, Don't just start preaching. Don't you take a sorry church and start preaching. Don't you go to a sorry Bible school. The world does not need any more sorry, uneducated preachers. Now, get you a good education. Go to a good school. And so they did. And this one fellow, they was telling a story, one after another, said, you know, I had signed up for his religion course, freshman. I hadn't been to class. Then I got the call to be a minister, and I knew I had to go face the music. So I went to Dean Carter, and he was giving a song and dance. Well, I hadn't been to class in 3 weeks, and blah, blah, blah. And Dean Carter, he said, he rudely, Dean Carter just turned on his heel, walked away, and said, sooner or later you're going to learn you have to do the work. You have to do the work. You can't just show up and go through the motions. And that was one of the things I remembered in one of those recovery weekend workshops or retreats, that one of the speakers was talking about how, well, he had a little entanglement with a vehicular problem related to DUI and so forth, and the judge thought this would be good for you to go to AA. And he was there, and he made it through his birthday. Oh, it's a big celebration for his birthday. And you know how you celebrate that, right? I mean, it's so magnificent. And then one guy, he says, oh, I want to come and give you a big hug. And he said, oh, man, I hated that hugging stuff. You know, you go to, and he said, and the guy had the big nose with the broken blood vessels. He was a classic alcoholic sort of thing. Comes over and he said, the guy comes and he gives me a big bear hug and he whispers in me. He said, you SOB, you had been doing the work. You're just faking everything. When you get ready to do the work, here's my card. He said, now that was his real birthday. You see that? And it's in church. It's in sports. It's in school. It's in marriages. It's in AA. It's in everything. You can show up and go through the motions, but you got to do the work. You got to do the work. Whatever you're facing. This is my belief, my theology. If you do the work, God, higher power, spirit, whatever you want to call him, her, it, they, is on your side and will support you. If you do your work, you put in the effort, then the universe rushes in to support you with what you need. The opportunities were given to me to do the work. When I did the work, then the universe opened up and supported me and helped me have the life that I believe our Creator intends for all of us to have, a life that is full of joy and laughter and goodness and relationships at work and jobs at work and every good thing. Do the work and the universe supports you. If you just go through the motion, you're just cheating yourself. I want to thank AA, thank all of you. It's a lifesaver for me, for you, and this planet, probably more than any other organization I know, has transformed lives and healed and helped people recover and live full and wonderful and bountiful lives. So thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for having me. God bless you.
I'm going to say her name first and then introduce her. Yael Shemelovitz. Okay? Rabbi, friend of AA, we're very pleased to have you with us. Thank you.
Hi, I'm from the Persuasion of Short, so can you, yeah. So, you know, it's absolutely heartening and amazing to see you here. I'll tell you a little bit more why later. It's not my experience, all this goodness in my professional life. So it's shocking, literally. So my name is Yael, I'm a Reform rabbi, and for those of you unaware, Reform is a fairly progressive denomination, Jewish denomination, progressive, there you go, they ordain lady rabbis, which I am. And thank you! But I don't work in congregational life, largely because of what George described. It doesn't appeal to me. It doesn't suit my personality. But what I am is I'm a CPE supervisor. And there's no reason on earth why any of you sitting... Oh, some person knows what that is! Oh, my God. Two people know what that is. Okay, that's unbelievable. There are around 600 of us in the entire USA, and CPE stands for Clinical Pastoral Educator, which is basically a person who teaches chaplains how to be chaplains. I'm also a chaplain myself, a palliative care chaplain, and I work out of Bellevue Hospital in New York City. Currently. I don't know what, cheering for Bellevue is awesome. So I basically train, I train students of clergy students of all faiths and anybody who goes into ministry. Usually people who go into ministry education dread CPE and dread CPE supervisors.
Yep.
Yes. What can I say? So I've had students, I don't know, I've had Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Hindus, Buddhists, Jews, church of whatever you want to call it, anything. And I train them basically to be professional story listeners and to help people connect to their own spiritual resources and enlarge them so that they can deal with whatever suffering they're going through. I work in a hospital setting, so as you can imagine, there is a tremendous amount of suffering. Now, let me just take it a little bit outside of the professional. So I was asked to reflect on when I first heard of AA. I was thinking about it and thinking about it, and I don't have a clue. I have no idea. See, I grew up in Israel. I didn't even grow up here. And I got here in my late 20s, and I cannot remember a time in my life where I didn't know what AA was. Still can't. I didn't meet alcoholism in my personal life or anything to support recovery, because I think in Israel, frankly, we're drunk on our anger. We don't need alcohol. I mean, not to say that it doesn't exist, but I not in my personal life. I guess it must have come from TV. But it's amazing, because I knew still in my teens, I could tell you, I could speak some of the lingo. I knew what a sponsor was. I knew what 12 steps were. I knew why anonymity was important. It's a big deal. So I guess it's a testament to how well integrated AA is into popular culture through the media. So it's also an inseparable part of how I understand the disease of alcoholism and what it means to be in recovery. Okay, so as an aside, you know, George alluded to that, but nobody who goes into ministry because they're well-adjusted people. You know? It's just, no. Because, you know, oh, I've had a wonderful childhood and I just want to share the joy. No. There's a lot of pain, and I'm no exception. And I grew up feeling very alienated in the culture that I grew up in, and I chose a geographical solution. I immigrated to the U.S. It worked. So, you know. But, well, you know, do the work. That's a big part of it. I immigrated, and that I'm still here is kind of a miracle. And every step of my way, having to deal with immigration, and it's been a struggle. And it forced me to come to terms with the parts of myself that are unattractive and ugly and want the things that will only poison me further. It's always a balancing act, doing this kind of work. Where are you feeding more into your own cuckoo? And where are you really healing and helping? So I wound up at Bellevue Hospital. And for those of you who are avid Law and Order fans, yay, I see nods. I am too. You know what that is, right? So Bellevue is a public hospital. City hospital, which means we take everybody in. We care for everybody regardless of whether or not they're insured. We deal with many undocumented, disenfranchised, underserved, We have so many different languages at Bellevue spoken that sometimes we can't even get a translator for a particular patient because their dialect that they speak is so rare up there in the mountains of, I don't know. It's amazing. And, one misconception is that it's a psychiatric hospital. There are 8 psych wards, which is a lot, but it's a medical center more than it is anything else. A huge percentage, or a large, I should say, percentage of the patients that we see on top of whatever medical issue they have or psychiatric issue also suffer from some form of substance abuse or other. We see it all the time. Just in comparison to where I came from, let me just tell you a quick story. I went to see my medical doctor not so long ago, a very nice young American girl in New York, and she heard that I was Israeli, and she said, "Oh, you know, I did like a few months in a hospital in Tel Aviv, and a rotation, and she was in the ER in a large, very well-known hospital in Tel Aviv, and this guy came in, and he was basically detoxing." And none of the doctors knew what that was. And they were like completely going berserk. She had also trained at Bellevue beforehand, and they were like, maybe we should get a nephrology specialist and we should put him on dialysis and what's going on here. And she said to them, she must have been like 26-year-old young woman, she said, "Guys, it's detoxing. I got this." And they all, the enormously different experience. So for many of our patients at Bellevue, and I say this, I'm going to use air quotes, right? Alcoholism makes sense in the sense that they're trying to medicate a tremendous amount of hurt. They're trying to medicate a life that is suffered generational injury. They're trying to medicate abuse, poverty, lack of social services, and it's something to go to. Of course, it doesn't work, right? It's not a good recipe for. I heard this from a friend in AA. It's not a good recipe for winning, right? Yeah, I'm reflecting on that. That the one requirement to be an AA is the desire to quit drinking. That's the one requirement which very often is lacking in the people that I meet. And that's partially why seeing you here is whoa, because I see the ones who repeatedly show up in the ER. I'm speechless for that. So the most challenging thing working with populations who suffer from high percentages of substance abuse is what in ministry we call, I don't know if that's PC, but we call it the tall tales, right? Every student that I have, every single one will meet the person who comes into the ER and got into a fight being intoxicated and got picked up by the police and woke up, you know, in a gurney, and they have no idea how they got there. But however they got there, it wasn't their fault. Right? So many countless stories. And I'm not exaggerating, every single one of my students will bring in what's called a verbatim. A verbatim is how we train people. They go up on the clinical floors, they visit with people, they write down the conversation verbatim, patient, chaplain, and then we bring it back to the classroom, we go over it. Every single one of my students will bring in a verbatim with the addiction narrative, which goes something like that. Something happened to me. I was a victim of this, this, and that. It wasn't my fault. I can do this. This is the last time I'm winding up on psych here. I know that I just got to think positive and God's going to be on my side. And every student is certain that they are the first person to ever hear this story, and that they are, just by listening to the story, that they're gonna, that's it, they've solved the problem. Like, it's gone. They've heard the story, the secret story of this patient, and they hold hands and they pray together, you know, may it come, amen, and that's it. And they bring in the verbatim, and I have to be like, oh, no. Oh my God. I remember my first story like that. I actually remember it. It was close to 10 years now ago. It was a Cuban guy he was so delightful. He was just so funny, has this really sexy accent, you know? And he was telling me this story about how he became addicted to alcohol. It goes the following. I was on a plane to America. I was going to come to America. And I was on the plane, and the stewardess kept serving me these little bottles. She kept bringing them on, and I tried to say no, but she kept bringing them on. And I was on a plane, and I couldn't get out. So I just kept drinking them. And by the time I got off the plane, I was an alcoholic. I know. Yeah. That really happened. And I have to teach, as I needed to learn, I have to teach my students, and it's really challenging, not to listen to the details of the story and just kind of like swallow them up. Because, people go into ministry at their core, yes, they're a little messed up, but they are good empathic listeners and they want to help. And so they're really trying hard to join the patient that they're talking to, and they're trying to feel along with them. And then I have to go and I have to tell them, listen, you're just kind of like going to swallow this hook, line, and sinker. It's not helping. It's not helping. And it won't help. So what I needed to learn, what I need to teach them is to listen to something more subtle underneath, is to listen not to the story that says it was the stewardess's fault and I couldn't get off the plane, but I can't get off the plane of my addiction, even though the person is not yet at a place where they can speak that as their story. And when that happens, and it happens so many times, we see so many of these patients, when I get frustrated like that because I can't quite figure out how to explain to a student how to be empathetic and how not to believe what they hear. You know, it's a really subtle line. I remember when that happens and I just feel like, ugh, I don't know what to do here as their teacher. I remind myself of the first step, right? That just the very first step. Admitting powerlessness and coming to terms with the fact that your life had become unmanageable. Well, the people that we see, they're not there. And I have to remember that. And that there is a chance and a hope that they will get there, and that's what you cling to. Because the balance between having power and powerlessness, it's actually really, really subtle. Right? Because to truly admit that you're powerless, it takes power. It's hard to wrap your head around it. It's hard for me. It's hard for my students. It's hard for people who suffer with addiction. I heard this from a different patient. He said, it takes energy to take in the light. Right? If you don't have energy, none of the light's going to come through. So this little realization helps me attune just ever so slightly. I don't even really change what I say, or I don't even want my students to change what they say, but it helps me attune to something underneath, right? Because the more fantastical the story, the more helplessness it alludes to. So I attune to the helplessness underneath, to being subject to this terrible disease and being completely powerless in the face of it. God is going to heal me. Hocus focus. I love that. You know, I'm going to get it right this time. God, how many times have I heard that? And I want it to be true, but it just isn't. So I tune to the story underneath it, and I pray not for the hocus pocus, but for the light to come, so that there would be enough, just enough of it, to be able to, like, put a half a foot, a teeny tiny, like, step towards recovery. And it's great because instead of, like, repeated visitors, shall we say, and they are, I get to see a lot of people in front of me surviving and thriving. It's just amazing. I wish I had that a year ago. Okay, so most of my patients, and that's a sad truth, they're not going to get to recovery. And why, you know, that's something to look at. I don't really fully know the reasons why. They just don't have access to the fellowship for a variety of reasons. I'm not really sure what they are, the socioeconomic or there's just too much damage. There isn't an ability to just to show up. One patient that sticks to with me was a palliative care patient of mine. Palliative care, not to go into it in too much detail, is a service that is looking at how to help people who we define it as suffering from serious illnesses. People always think that that's when you're dying. Well, you know, it could be diabetes as well. So if you're suffering chronically, we try to look at the entirety of your life and see how to make that better. So I had a patient who was just also delightful, and he had, is it a history if it's still going on? I don't know. Alcoholism, drug abuse. He contracted HIV when he was 27, and he was told that he had HIV on his 27th birthday. That was his birthday gift. Somebody from the state followed him wherever he was living. It was actually in a circus, really, not like a metaphorical, like a real circus. That's what he did, and tracked him down and told him, congrats, you have HIV, something cruel like that. And he said, I didn't think I was going to live to 35. So he lived even more, he lived completely without consequences. By the time I met him, he was 54. Go figure. And then he was dying of leukemia. But he didn't die of the HIV. He'd never contracted AIDS. And I talked to him, and what are you afraid of? What is the thing that you're most afraid of? It's just something we ask palliative patients. And he said, he was weepy, and he said, I'm afraid to die alone. I'm afraid to die alone. And I just thought, whatever, I'm not going to let that happen. And I tracked his family down on Facebook. But his family didn't want to talk to him because he had basically sold everything that they had owned, you know? God knows what else, embarrassed them, or, you know, his dad told me, I heard he's into drugs and alcohol and he drinks and he's just, anyway. Eventually they talked to each other, but it took months to convince the patient to call up his dad once I found him and that his dad would listen to him. Just the shame of the disease, it covered the entire relationship. I don't know if this is a happy ending or not. I don't know. I don't know. Because he did die alone. Sort of. There were people around him. There was me, and then there was the medical team, and he did get to talk to his dad, and he found out what happened to his mom, who he had lost touch with, like decades ago. My point is that it's really hard for me to keep up hope a lot of the time in my professional life because most of my patients will not see recovery and won't be in this room. But you are. And because of that, because most of my patients won't, I believe all the more so in the fellowship. Because first of all, hey, it's a fellowship, right? There's other human beings. With that, it does, in the way that I look at it from my perspective as a clergy person and as a teacher of clergy, that the group has a tremendous healing power. It's magical almost. We kind of, in this culture, we learn to do things independently by ourselves, and we hold up self-reliance as one of the highest values. Oh, boo. So the fellowship, just by existing, battles loneliness and isolation and the shame, just this poisonous shame that exists. It's magical. And the second reason, which I think was articulated much more eloquently than I could, is that AA at its core is a deeply spiritual, I'm going to say phenomenon, because I don't know what else to call it, a movement, a program, or what. I'm going to say a spiritual phenomenon that stresses that we need each other to live. And that whatever you believe at the core of it, whatever you believe, you want to call it God, Spirit, Shekhinah, you want to call it Baba, whatever, it reminds you that the broken body, the incomplete life story, the person who made mistake after mistake, that broken body self isn't the beginning of the story. And it isn't the end of the story. And that's all my story is. Thank you.
Can you stick around a few minutes? If Bishop Benedict gets here, you will see me sit down quickly. But let me share a couple of things. I want to really say something about John's statement, which struck me so clearly, that clergy like to be up and perform and be respected and honored. I even get goosebumps right now because that is so true. And that's why this fellowship has been so important to me. So I know many of you have heard my story about how I got involved. I got involved as a parish priest. I was in a small congregation in Louisville, Kentucky, and began to see that alcohol was causing problems with some of my parishioners. Now, before that, I'd always thought alcohol was kind of cool. And if somebody had vomited at the country club and dented his car getting out of the parking lot, he just had a hard week, right? Well, for the first time in my ministry, I was going on Saturday mornings and Sunday afternoons to visit parishioners in the jail who had gotten paid, gotten to a bar, spent most of their paycheck, and gotten in a fight and gotten arrested. And that seemed like a problem. And my eyes began to become open, and young people in the parish told me about their families, and I said, I need to know something about this disease. So I went to the experts. I started attending open meetings, and I still attend open meetings. But what really happened, that would have been about 1975, 76. In 1980, Willie, who was a member of my congregation, had 7 years sobriety in AA, knew I was attending open meetings. I knew he was in AA. Walked into my office, and he said, Ward, you're the spiritual expert, right? I don't think I answered that. He went on to say, I'm out of touch with God, and the last time I was out of touch with my higher power, I drank, and if I drink again, I may die, and I need you to put me back in touch with God. And y'all know how serious he was. And I knew, thank God I knew I couldn't do that. And so we talked and we talked again, and we decided what we needed were members of this fellowship who had at least 5 years sobriety and wanted to talk about some of the spiritual issues in their life. And so we put together a little group. It wasn't an AA group. Sort of wasn't an AA group. But they were all members of AA. They gathered every Tuesday afternoon, 4 o'clock, to talk about spiritual issues in their life. And guess which spiritual expert got converted? That's when I learned what this fellowship was about. That's when I began practicing the 12 steps. I have to say, I still have trouble with step 6. That entirely ready? I love my defects. anyway, that's when I began, and I'm still working at him. I always think of Willie as my first sponsor. But the most important thing in that group, as John alluded to, clergy aren't asked to be honest. Clergy are expected to be good. That's a hell of a place to be because we can't. But that's no problem. We can fake it. Because you want it, we'll fake it, and everybody believes it. And it's no wonder you get depressed, right? That's depressing. You have no one. Maybe a spouse. That's a pretty heavy load for a spouse to be a whole AA fellowship. But no one else that you can share your thoughts, your feelings, your fears, your hurts, your joys, anything. This group did not give a damn about what I had done. They only cared that I be as honest as I could about it. And that's life transforming. And that's part of what's so wonderful about this fellowship. It doesn't matter what you've done. You just need to be as honest as you can. And 2 years later, you will discover there's another level to that honesty. But we go where we are as best we can, as honest as we can. Bill said, it's those who can't be honest that don't make this program. And that is so important, and it is so life-giving. It is so life-giving. And I thank you, because you really gave me life. You may have saved my life, I don't know. But since 1980, this fellowship has been the heart of my spiritual program. And the 12 steps have been center in my spiritual program. And it's been a wonderful time of growth and joy, road to happy destiny, all those things. You know, the promises are really true. And I've been really privileged to have a chance to be a part in my way. And I didn't even have to pay the dues, you know. It's really been a great privilege. I missed my good line. I know some of you heard it, but the rest of you need to hear this. This is those in 1975, if any of you were around at AA meetings, they were a little smoky. In fact, if you sat in the back, you might not be able to see the speaker. And I would come home at night after coming to a meeting, and I would open the door and I'd say, "Jenny, I'm home." And she would say, "Yes, I smell you. Take off your clothes, leave it," which was a pretty mixed message. So thank y'all for laughing at that. Yeah. And let me pick up again on one of John's statements about most of us who are religious began as spiritual, and our faith began as a spiritual program, not as a religion. Religion gets pretty involved with setting up true belief. If you don't believe, you're not a member. Setting up rituals that, at least in the Episcopal Church, if you come into the Episcopal Church for the first time, you sit there going, "What is going on in this place? They're up and down, and then they turn and greet each other." But then they don't. We had people. I used to have visitors who, when we would pass the peace, it got a little carried away in my church. And I would have visitors thought the service was over. Well, we were just halfway through. But so it's a little confusing. Religion gets ritual, it gets theology, and above all else, it defines who's a member. You're either in or you're out. And one of the ways we know you're in is if you give us money. Because raising money and building buildings and taking care of all of those things have a way of invading the spiritual life, to where the spiritual life is just getting squeezed out of the church. AA is not a religion. And spirituality, unlike a religious doctrine and a set of beliefs and a ritual and an ethic, we believe in progress, not perfection. For a perfectionist, those are the most wonderful words I ever heard in my life. Spirituality is open. We begin with the understanding that if you're human and get up in the morning, you're a spiritual person. Because spirituality is anything that you do not see. Spiritual things are anything you do not see that affects your life. Love, anger, hate, friendship, serenity, joy, sadness. Those are spiritual realities. I spoke last fall at the International Conference for Atheists, Agnostics, and Freethinkers in AA. A wonderful conference, I want to say. That was one of the most fabulous conferences. And people with 20, 30 years sobriety and the wisdom and the insight they had. And they understand that spiritual things, they don't like the word spiritual, but they understand that spiritual things are all those things that affect our lives that we cannot see. That's what it is to be. So guess what? Everybody is spiritual. And that's where AA begins, with a spiritual program that's there for everyone, even those of us who didn't have to pay the dues. It's inclusive. You know, AA integrated 3 years after it was founded. The U.S. integrated 30 more years later, I think, and we're still fighting the battles. I remember my first year as a member of trustees, we were going over the pamphlet for, I think it was titled then, Homosexuals in AA, and revising it. And it needed revision, but I looked at the date on it, 1981. This fellowship was so far ahead because there's only one thing, one requirement for membership, and that's the desire to stop drinking. That's the desire to stop drinking. That's it. And that, of course, is why I'm a little uncomfortable with the Lord's Prayer. I say the Lord's Prayer. I love the Lord's Prayer. I actually did a Promises retreat in Oklahoma this spring, and one of the meditations I gave them was on the Lord's Prayer, because I said everybody thinks I hate the Lord's Prayer. I don't hate the Lord's Prayer. I love it. I think it's a prayer for this fellowship. But at open meetings in particular, when somebody walks into their first meeting and they hear a lot of God talk, which, you know, most members of this fellowship, when they first came, didn't have a really good conscious contact with God. In fact, they just as soon avoid that, right? And you hear the God talk, and then to hold hands and close with the Lord's Prayer, and this is your first meeting, it's a little off-putting. And I have heard stories, and you have too, of members who left after that, but ultimately the disease forced them back. But I've not heard stories of people who may have left and not come back. And that's why I'm really uncomfortable. I do understand each group is autonomous. You make your own decisions. This is not a direct... Every once in a while when I've talked about this, somebody calls New York and says, "Do you know what the chair of the board said? He said we can't use the Lord's Prayer." I'm not saying that. I'm saying very clearly I'm uncomfortable at open meetings because we need to be open to those who are coming, many with hostility, resentments, often well-earned resentments against religion, because the church is not, churches have not been particularly helpful. Yeah, particularly helpful to those who are still drinking and are suffering from this disease. Judgment, condemnation have been too far the norm. But every group makes its own decision. I'm less uncomfortable. I don't go to closed meetings, so I don't know whether I'm uncomfortable at closed meetings or not. But, we need to be really careful that we keep this fellowship open to anyone who comes. It is a spiritual program. Spirituality is available to every human being. It is a powerful program. It transforms humans' lives. And let's not cut anybody off at the very beginning. Amen. Are you telling me something about Bishop Benedict? No, I'm sorry. We don't do questions and responses at this forum. No, I'm going to be good and follow the rules. Let's get together afterward, okay? Okay, 5 more minutes? Good, we just got the word. One of the things that I find so incredibly wonderful in this fellowship is the openness to the fact that there is a power greater than ourselves that does indeed bring things together. I've often thought of God as not a God that takes care of us, but God that gives us new opportunities all the time. Because we get ourselves in trouble, and every time we do, there's somehow a new opportunity. And above all else, God is that kind of God of opportunity. And listening to John's stories, listening to Yael's story, you see that power, that invisible spiritual power is somewhere involved in that. And somebody talked to John and said, come to a meeting. You need it. Yael doesn't even know when that voice was first heard for her, but she did learn to listen with a skeptical ear to the stories that she heard, seeking for the deeper truth. Those kinds of events that happened, but that Willie walked into my office, that I continued. By the way, I started about half a dozen 11th step groups. When I moved from Louisville, I went to Buffalo, New York. One of the more fundamentalist neighbors came by, saw the for sale sign on my house, and said to my wife, y'all moving, where are you going to? She said, Buffalo, New York. And there was this kind of long pause, and she looked at her in somewhat disbelief, and she said, you mean God called you to Buffalo? So I tried to recreate that group that had been so important in my life. You know how you get a gift once, and it's a wonderful gift, and gratitude is the response, not control, not try to make it happen again. And I today am just grateful for that. But one of the side products was 2 or 3, maybe 4, 5, 6. I'm not even sure how many 11th step groups I got by groups that were coming together to talk about their spiritual problems and issues in AA. I had something else I was going to say. Hang on just a second. It's there. It's there. It's coming. Probably did have something to do with control. I'm certainly feeling out of control and powerless at the moment. So that makes me a part of it. Oh, I know what it was. It was how. See, all you got to do is admit that you're powerless, and there it is. That's how God works. Well, in terms of thinking about how our higher power works. So I'm the dean at General Seminary in New York City. I'm looking for a new CFO. I'm interviewing Michael M. Some of you may know Michael, to be my CFO at General. And one of the things I'd learned I've really learned a lot about alcoholism, actually, in 30 years. And one of the things I did with him was ask him about his drinking. And he asked me why I asked him. And I said, well, there's this and there's that. Those are kind of typical alcohol behaviors. And he said to me, well, I've got 22 years sobriety in AA. And I said, that's fabulous. But he didn't let that go. He asked me, you know, why did you ask me? And so I shared with him my story of my time in AA. We had a wonderful conversation. I offered him the job. He said, let me call you tomorrow. I really would like to come and work for you. I think it'd be fabulous. He called me tomorrow and he said, his partner had said, you just retired last week. You're not going to work again. And so he did not take the job. About 2 months later, he called me up and said, would you be interested in being a trustee of the General Service Board? Guess who was interviewing whom? You know? And I didn't think at the time, but I have many, many times later. What an incredible way these connections get made and the way it happens. It's just, there is a God who continues to offer us opportunities for growth, for new life, for getting it together. And it's a good thing it's continuous, because we continue to need that growth and that new life and that getting together. And I really want to thank this fellowship for what you've given to me and what you've given to, I mean, obviously the gratitude that you have. And one of the most exciting events is tonight. Those of you who've been to an international before know what I'm saying. Those who haven't, when you walk into that, as a trustee, walk into that auditorium for the first time, and you hear the noise, This, I mean, it makes football games seem mild. Because it's people who are so grateful for what God has done to them through this fellowship. And it is just a mind-blowing, fabulous evening. So for those of you who haven't been there before, and we bring in the flags, it's get ready. Get ready to be blown away. Because that is the moment when we realize there really is a power greater than anybody in this group. I think one of the problems with those who have difficulty with God is that, you know, good orderly direction doesn't make it. It really does, not in the long run. But what I discovered with my friends in California is it wasn't good orderly direction, it was the power of the group. Esprit de corps was a word they liked. And I thought that's a good name. That's a good name for this higher power. Because there is a power that's greater than just advice or just a single person walking with us. There's a spirit of AA that forms and directs and heals and offers new opportunity over and over and over. And it's really fabulous. And where are you, Bishop Benedict? That's a long 5 minutes. I'm really just saying that because I do want to hear from him. I personally want to hear from him. He is a Catholic bishop from Ukraine. We've been doing the Ukrainian Catholic Church. We've been doing a lot of work with Ukraine. There's some very exciting things happening in the fellowship there. I really, really... Oh, you're from Ukraine? All right. Most of the news we hear from Ukraine isn't so good these days. And there really is some good news happening. Our higher power is working in Ukraine. And it's very exciting. And I really, really want to hear from him. And we will end on time. And that's a problem. Ah, here we are. Introducing you. So you're wrong. And we do have to end on time, but you're good.
Since God, I am here. It's a big pleasure for me to be and to stay with you. My English not so good. Maybe I speak Ukrainian and my friend Yuri a little bit translate me. Because when I speak my English, a little bit poor. You know, I am a bishop and I am a monk. I am from Ukraine. My first experience with a movement in 3 years ago in Canada. For that time, I have been many times in the open meeting in AA meeting. I have met with many times, and maybe first time when I have been in this meeting. It's maybe difficult to understand for you. I am a bishop and I don't fall in law. It's impossible for me, yes? But when I'm visit the first time your meeting, I fall in law in your movement. Which is the reason why in fall in law? Because I feel if authenticity, because when we see in our life, we always play some roles, different kinds of roles, like mother, father, or some place when you work. But when I meet people who belong to your community, your movement, they always authenticity. But when you would like to meet somebody, it's important when you meet with somebody, not with a mask. It's not mask. It's possible to connect and meet a real person. And when I have occasion, I will visit and meet people from AA movement. In Christianity, sometimes we don't think about this. We would like change our life by ourselves. We try many things. You know about this when you have your problem. But it's impossible to do something by yourself. You always need somebody who help you. And this point of view is very important in your movement. It's helped me understand my spiritual life. It's not I can do everything in my life by myself. I need help for somebody. For me, it's God. But it thank your movement help me this understand better and better. What is important when I connect with your movement, when you heal, you recover, you need help another person. It's very important for now because it's much important for our country, because in our country we long time under communistic regime, and we live many situations egoistic. We don't understand when I heal, I need help another. Your movement teach us this very well. What is another very important for me when I connect with your movement? Everybody have subjective point of view. Yes? Everybody. When somebody say you, I understand this objectively, it's not real. What I learned from your movement, you work together. It's like our body, yes? When we have our body, everything is our body serve for another. Our heart serve for all body. It's like all of you serve all your movement, all your community. It's important to understand, I don't live alone in this world. It's impossible. Yes, it's possible to live alone for animals, but impossible to live alone for people. We need community. We need help for another person. I say something, what is relationship in our country with your movement, AA, and our church. About 80 meetings, your groups at our city have at our church. It's a big number. We have so close relationship. Most of them believe on God. But we understand you have autonomy. I understand. Yes, I understand sometimes have a little bit difficult relationship, but it's not so often. You know, when you live together a person, you always have some problems. It's true? Our priest always, when somebody need help, they send you must to go to AA movement. Because we understand, you know the best what do this. It's impossible for me help this person. Because I don't know, I don't have experience. Maybe I will be have experience. Who knows? But no, I don't have. And when somebody have some problems with alcohol, I say him, you must go to this meeting. Because they have so big experience. They help you. in our country, we have big authority of church. It's very important for people, for somebody from church say, somebody, you must go to that moment. Because it's better for you. Yes, it's possible for you, it's important for you when you go to church, but when you need special help, you need to go to this moment. We would like to have this autumn big meeting for about 300 our priests with AA movement, with AA person. We would like to explain them better in which way they need to help this person which have problem with alcoholism. Can help me? Maybe you explain me about this.
He asked me to mention that there was a decision made with the synod where all the bishops from... There's 4 million people who belong to the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. And every year the bishops get together from all of Ukraine and they talk about, you know, very important things. And Bishop Benedict pointed out that they need to have a closer relationship with AA. And so now, you know, throughout Ukraine, support. Yes, so that's beginning to happen.
I say something about AA in Ukraine. It's my point of view. It's not objective point of view. You know how this movement so quickly grew in United States. You know very well. But it's different situation in Ukraine. I ask myself, why is not? Why is growth not so quickly? I think it's the biggest problem in the Soviet time. We live in country which is close. It's like big prison. Prison? It's like big prison. It's people always afraid about spies. They are very afraid. When you meet in when I visit to United States, I see everybody smile, everybody open, everybody ask you, can you help some help? Would you like to send help? In our country, our people is hospitality. Yes, it's true. But we always afraid. In the same problem is AA movement in Ukraine. They heal, yes, but it's so, sometimes, not always, it many situations so difficult for them help another person. Because they afraid. What another person think about me? What do you think? I think we need a little bit step by step change this mentality, and our church would like to help. Another problem in Ukrainian, we have so big problem with young people who have problems with alcoholism. Why? Because we have before one ideology. We can say it's good, bad, but it's one ideology. But nowadays we don't have some ideology how to live. And people sometimes don't know. They grow up without church. They grow up. They didn't have good formation. And many of them now drink alcohol. I think at that moment, AA movement need meet with young people. Explain them. Help them, but because in many situations they don't understand, they do bad thing. Because there many of our people, many of their parents went to another country and work. In many cases, children stay at home without parents. And I think this situation, a moment important when they teach. Explain this young generation. Another point, this is my point of view. Very important when Ukraine, AA movement, have good relation with church. Why? Because I told you before, a church in a Ukrainian society have big, big authority. And this situation, a movement can use this authority. Yes, I understand AA movement need autonomy. Yes, I understand this very well. But you can use what I told you when they use now, when they meet at the church and people understand this something good, something important for their heal. I think it's help us and help AA movement in our situation. In the end.
He's telling me to tell you about a story that, and it's a true story because I met the gentleman. He went to confession. You know, those of you who know Catholicism go to confession, well, once a year at least. And, and they have to make their Easter duty. So this fellow waited till the very end on Good Friday, went to confession and, he thought that he would get, you know, 100 Hail Marys or whatever and, The priest said, no, you need to go to AA. And he said, okay, so I'll go next week. And he'll go. And he said, no, you'll go today. There's a meeting in this church right now. And so then they told Bishop Benedict, now you need to instruct all the priests to do the same.
Thank you very much. Excuse me for my English. Maybe when in the future, maybe in the future when I will stay here, I will understand much better. But I must to say you this. You do very important job. You understand. You must understand when you must to do this, because when you don't do this, who do? It's your responsibility. You know, people at the day need, yes, in your family, your city, everywhere. And another point is not easy. I understand. When I wait one moment in the A movement in Ukraine, I understand they have some problems with relationship, with different partner. Remember, you know this, what I told you. But you don't afraid this. I will say you. I will guarantee you. You will have problem until the death. It's always our life when we have some problems. In Chinese language, do you know? Some hieroglyph is the same problem, the same hieroglyph, great opportunity. You know, it's great opportunity. And I will thank you very much. And it's big deal for me when I stay here because I will understand better your spirit. And I will take the spirit with me in Ukraine. And I will think a movement in Ukraine grow much better. Thank you very much. It may be. And I invite you, maybe in the future, we will have some conventions in Ukraine. Yeah.